another episode of MSK Matters, the podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Allie Rendley. Today's episode focuses on foot and ankle sports injuries. The foot is an intricate structure with 26 bones, 33 joints, and more than 100 muscles, tendons, and ligaments, and the ankle joint is made up of three bones. This complex network of structures must all work together to provide support to the rest of the body, which allows us to stand, walk, and play sports. When assessing foot and ankle injuries, the foot can be divided into the forefoot, midfoot, and hindfoot. And while the anatomy can seem overwhelming for learners, foot and ankle injuries are very common in sports, and becoming familiar with these injuries, you're going to see them on the sideline, in the emerge, or in clinic, is a necessity. To help us delve into this topic, I'm joined by co-host Dr. Chris Wavell, PGY2, physiatry resident at the University of Toronto, and guest expert Dr. Fahim Morali. He's a fellowship-trained sport and exercise medicine physician at the DaVinci Orthopedic Sports Medicine Clinic at Mount Sinai Hospital in Toronto. He trained at McMaster University and the University of Toronto. He has a special interest in ultrasound-guided intervention and works with Team Canada basketball. Thank you both for joining me today.
So let's jump right into it with the first case. We'll start with a basketball player jumping up for a rebound, and he comes down and feels like he inverts his ankle, having immediate pain. We'd like to ask you, Dr. Morali, what are your initial thoughts with this injury?
The inversion mechanism during basketball is probably the most common injury that we see in that sport. Normally, what I would expect is some degree of injury to the ATFL and the CFL. Usually the ATFL is more common. And in the same mechanism of inversion, you can stretch anything along in that side of the lateral side of the foot and ankle. So usually we think about the peroneal tendon as well. And when it's an acute injury, usually we're just assessing for making sure that there's no fracture as the primary concern. And then later on, we can start delving into whether there is any ligamentous injury or muscular injury, assuming that it's going to be some sort of mild or moderate severity. When there is an acute injury, there's also bleeding to expect from the ligament and potentially from the bone. If it is a ligamentous bleeding, that's when you'll see lots of swelling and bruising almost immediately after the injury. And if there's someone trained on the sideline, for example, in a professional game, they might try to tamp out the bleeding externally by putting a horseshoe or some sort of tight wrapping, or you'll hear some people say, you know, tie your laces. And that's to try to reduce or at least mitigate the inflammation and bleeding so that the eventual recovery can be a bit faster.
What are some of the symptoms and things you're looking for initially to suggest more severe injury? Or in other words, when are you worried?
So initially, at the time of injury, the swelling and the bruising definitely would indicate a more severe injury. Usually, if there's some sort of tear that's bleeding, you're expecting at least a medium grade injury or even a severe injury, depending on the mechanism. So if somebody has a really dramatic video or a dramatic story of how they got hurt or a really high velocity mechanism, that should automatically alert you to the idea that it might be a more severe injury. You're most worried about a fracture, because if there's a displaced fracture, it may lead to improper healing if it's not treated immediately. And then the second worry is kind of the clinic scenario, where a patient comes in having had an injury, let's say a week or 2 weeks or a month ago, and it's still not healing, or they're worried about the pain or the injury. That at that point, you're more concerned about something turning into a chronic pain, or in a very rare case, something like a chronic regional pain syndrome or CRPS. Those things are more rare. Even just having an unhealing lateral ligament injury is more rare than it just getting better. And at that point, you're worried about the mechanics of the ankle and how much rest and rehab it's getting. And you're just trying to troubleshoot the treatment process with them, and not as concerned about the immediate fracture concerns at that time.
if you were on the sideline, how do you know when a player can stay in a game with this type of injury, or if you need to take them out for further assessment?
That's actually a more simple answer than it sounds like it should be. It's really just about function. So if the player can hop around and skip around and they're walking really well and they're telling you they're fine, they're probably fine. And if they have a huge swelling and they're limping around and they can't run, let alone walk, then it's a no-brainer. There are certain scenarios where, you know, there might be a small fracture or something a really tough player can play through. And if you're really worried about a specific location, and you think there might be a displaced injury, for example, a medial malleolus or multiple locations in the ankle, I think that should usually correlate with the player just not being able to go. And if there's a small injury, you could be taking a little risk of missing it, but the fact that it's small tells you that it's probably okay to try. And you usually also have a second opinion, and usually you're the second opinion, but there's a therapist or a trainer or someone who's already assessed the player and also given their kind of go ahead. And then the player also, usually people are pretty good at triaging themselves and saying, I can go or I can't.
Okay. And are we worried about further injury or making their original injury worse if they do go play?
I think that always should be a concern, especially depending on the original severity. However, the context of the situation will also determine what you do. So if you're in a recreational game and you're kind of a normal, you know, college age or middle-aged person, weekend warrior, maybe you don't push it. Maybe it's not worth it. You have work to get to. You have a job where you're on your feet. It's probably not worth risking the injury. On the other hand, you are a professional athlete making millions of dollars, and it's a playoff game. You're probably going to take the risk. So you have to be worried about it. The good side of being a professional athlete in terms of the recurrent injury is that you have a trainer or a therapist who's taped up the ankle, or you've gotten some advice to put on a specific brace or tie your shoes a certain way to try to mitigate re-injuring that ankle or that structure. And then again, you're kind of reassessing as you go. The chances of having two freak accidents of like stepping on someone's ankle or landing funny twice is a little bit lower. So I think it's fair to take it in the right context and decide based on that.
Okay. And I was wondering if you could touch on a low versus a high ankle sprain.
A high ankle sprain is actually a completely different injury than your typical inversion mechanism where you're tearing the ATFL and the CFL. The high ankle sprain is actually a syndesmotic injury. So the syndesmosis is the connection between the tibia, which makes the medial malleolus, and the fibula, which makes the lateral malleolus. So that injury, even the mechanism is completely different. Rather than the inversion, you're expecting some sort of external rotation force of the leg while the ankle is dorsiflexed. Sometimes we also link it with an eversion mechanism, and sometimes that high ankle sprain occurs in conjunction with a deltoid injury, which is the medial ligamentous complex, much less likely to be injured than the ATFL, just because of the level of stability. So the syndesmosis is essentially where the tibia and fibula are linked, and that link goes all the way up the leg. So there's an interosseous membrane that joins the bones all the way up to the level of the knee. And sometimes the force that's exerted on the ankle can actually travel up if it doesn't have a breaking point somewhere lower down, and can actually cause an injury or a fracture up near the fibular head, or the superior tibiofibular joint. So that's that little prominence on the lateral part of the knee where the fibula is. And you always want to palpate that. That fracture is called a Maisonneuve fracture. It's kind of a pathognomonic fracture for a syndesmotic injury lower down on the ankle. It's quite rare, but it's something that you'll find in your textbooks. The real reason that high ankle sprains are of concern, other than usually the velocity that's required to cause those injuries, is that the connection point between the fibula and the tibia there is what creates the top of the ankle joint, the tibial plafond, where it meets the fibula, and also just makes up the mortise of the ankle. So that alignment of the mortise is very, very important. That joint needs to be congruent to the millimeter for the alignment and the mobility of the ankle to be normal. And if there's any sort of widening because of a big ligament tear or any sort of disruption of the medial or lateral gutter on the ankle, it can create chronic pain, it can create abnormal biomechanics, and then it can eventually end up with osteoarthritis in the ankle joint. So that injury usually needs to be treated a little bit with a little bit more respect than, or at least with caution, compared to just a standard inversion ankle injury.
Okay, so is this why it is harder to rehab or recover from high ankle injuries or sprains?
That's part of the reason. The other possible reason is because the ankle joint itself is inflamed or irritated. Sometimes you'll find an effusion in conjunction with that syndesmotic injury. It's really hard to rest the ankle without really just offloading it. And there's really nothing you can strengthen per se about that ligament. It's not really as dependent on the external stabilizing musculature as a lateral or even medial ligament complex injury would be. It's just right in the middle of the ankle. The other issue is it's commonly missed because it's not as common and we just don't think about it as much. And having a delayed treatment of that injury can also lead to a little bit more chronicity.
And so could you walk us through some of the key things that you're looking for on physical exam when trying to determine if there is a high ankle sprain, and if you would suggest any imaging?
First of all, the mechanism is the most important. You have to know exactly what happened. Sometimes the injury was too fast and they don't know. But for the most part, they should be able to tell you that at least it wasn't just a normal inversion. Something else weird happened. It everted, or there was a really high velocity kind of rotational injury. Normally, a severe syndesmotic injury would come in looking like lots of swelling around the ankle joint, not necessarily just at the lateral border. It might even be an effusion. And sometimes it's difficult to determine if there's an effusion or if it's just soft tissue swelling. But typically, if there's kind of a puffy area in the medial side, just medial to the tibialis anterior, which is usually quite prominent, then you might think that there's an effusion. You can also confirm that with imaging if necessary, like an ultrasound. In terms of the mobility, patients might have a little bit more difficulty than expected ambulating. They might not be putting the weight on their leg properly. They might already be in crutches because they were in the eMERGE, or they might already be in a boot, which I think would be appropriate. And I can touch on that more in a second. In terms of the physical exam, other than the inspection where you see lots of swelling, you might expect more tenderness kind of anteriorly on the ankle rather than just laterally around the ATFL. And specifically around the connection point between the tibia and the fibula, which is exactly where the syndesmosis is. It's kind of just lateral of center along the ankle and a little bit more proximal than the tibio-talar joint, just a little bit higher than it. One clinical exam maneuver you can do to confirm is to passively externally rotate the foot. So you're just holding the leg stable and you're just turning the foot outward into external rotation. And what that does is it kind of mimics the mechanism of injury. And that motion actually spreads the tibia and the fibula apart. So that should be quite painful if you already have even a partial AITFL injury, the anterior inferior tibiofibular ligament, which is what is injured usually when we talk about a high ankle sprain. Another way to look for that is to around the mid-calf area to squeeze the tibia and fibula together. And that also affects the AITFL. In this case, we'd be compressing it. And so either pressing on it or releasing it should cause some irritation to the ligament, which can also lead you down the high ankle sprain path. And then finally, the palpation, which we touched on. If you're really suspicious about it, even before, if you're not in the eMERGE, the first thing you should do is actually just treat it. And again, that will depend on the patient's mobility. If they come in 2 months later and they're walking fine, it might not be as big of a concern. But if they're coming in with an acute injury and they're already having trouble walking, it will be that much easier to convince them and convince yourself that they need an air cast boot or to be on crutches if the boot isn't appropriate. And then you can worry about getting the imaging and confirm. On the x-ray, if they have a really severe injury, you might see some widening between the tibia and the fibula. And there are certain measurements that you can look for both on the AP view and on the mortise view of the ankle. Mostly the measurements are the same. And essentially you're looking for widening of the syndesmosis. You can also get an MRI to rule out a high ankle sprain if it's important, or you know, if there are some return to play considerations, or if there's some chronicity to it. But I would say that the treatment is actually more important than waiting for imaging, especially if you have a long wait for imaging. It may not factor into your clinical judgment as much.
Okay. And so you've touched on it a little bit with the boot and various things. I was wondering if we could go through some of the treatment and your approach, maybe just some of the more mild cases and what you do in some of the more severe cases.
So for a high ankle sprain specifically, the first course of action is just to immobilize the foot, or at least to offload the foot. You don't need a cast, but a boot is helpful because it can distribute the weight bearing a little bit more evenly. And if that's still too painful, then crutches are definitely appropriate, at least for 1 or 2 weeks. And then you can graduate to the boot when appropriate. My general rule would be somewhere between 2 and 4 weeks. If you trust the patient enough to be able to use their judgment, then you can tell them to wear it for 2 weeks straight and then wean out of it slowly and kind of go back and forth between more or less use based on how they're feeling. And you really can use comfort as your guide for this. If they're a younger patient or you're not sure if they'll follow the instructions, then just tell them to wear it for 4 weeks straight and you can mitigate the stiffness that might cause later on with some rehab. And then you can also get them in to see the physiotherapist who will help them with some, the joint mobility, getting rid of the swelling, slowly getting to weight bear when it's appropriate, and just making sure that the rest of the lower extremity and the biomechanical chain is working well, because the boot is not comfortable. It changes how you walk. It's a lot higher than your normal shoe. Everything else starts hurting while you wear it. So the physiotherapist or whoever rehab specialist really comes in handy when you're having these kind of reactive or compensatory pains.
We see a lot in clinic, more recreational athletes come in with recurrent low ankle sprains, that kind of sensation of instability where they just feel like they're rolling it more frequently. Mm-hmm. What's kind of your rehab or treatment protocol that you offer for these individuals that are still kind of able to play through, but just don't feel as confident on that ankle?
Normally offer them some sort of brace to wear while they're playing until the ankle is feeling pretty stable, especially if it's not a really chronic injury. There may be still some healing to be had if they can stop injuring the ankle. And my brace of choice is usually a figure of eight brace that has some less elastic straps that go around each side of the foot and stop inversion and eversion mechanism injuries. In terms of the rehab itself, usually the problem I'm finding is that people stop too quickly and most of the injuries are kind of incompletely rehabilitated. You do a little bit of band exercises and you do some balance and then it kind of just felt better with time. You're 90% better and you just stopped. But a lot of the stabilization of the foot that's done statically with the ligaments is, even if it's slightly altered, now needs to be done by the muscular structures, and they're not exactly meant for that. They're more dynamic stabilizers. So if you're relying on those structures to help with stabilization, they probably need to be quite a bit stronger and have more endurance than you normally expect. And so I would say that just like any exercise, you have to progress through multiple levels of rehab until the ankle is extremely stable, and having good balance and good proprioception is kind of the bare minimum at that point, especially if you're having recurrent injuries. And then at some point, if despite that, it's still frequently getting injured, that's when something like an MRI might be helpful, because if there's a large tear in some of those stabilizing structures, the ligaments, that is not healing properly. There might be some other indications, for example, a surgical reconstruction at the kind of most aggressive end of the spectrum to help stabilize the ankle again.
I think that's common, what we see in physiatry and in rehab, that people just want to get back to it too soon. Yeah. So it's important to walk them through those steps, and the proprioceptive retraining is a big component that kind of comes after you are feeling much better. So I think that's important. All right, we can move on to case two.
This is a football case where we have an offensive lineman blocking, and the running back is behind them, and they're tackled behind the line of scrimmage, and they fall forward, landing on the back of the heel of the offensive lineman. What are some of your thoughts about this mechanism and some of the potential injuries that you're thinking about?
The first thing that you want to think about is usually kind of the most rare thing, because those are the things that require the highest index of suspicion. So the Lisfranc injury with that kind of mechanism, if the foot is plantar flexed and there's some axial loading, or if there's like a high velocity injury, a land from a large height, you want to think about the Lisfranc joint or the Lisfranc ligament. Now, before we even get there, there are a lot more common things that can cause, that can be injured in that kind of mechanism. There are lots of bones and lots of ligaments around the foot. And if you look at a good anatomical diagram of the foot, you can see that almost every bone is connected by a ligament. And there are a large number of joints that go through the foot, and all of those joints can be potentially injured. So all of those need to be considered as separate structures. So the first thing I would do is think about the Ottawa foot rules, especially in an acute injury, keeping in mind that the foot rules don't cover the metatarsals. And you also want to think about metatarsal fractures and dislocations and even the cuboid bone. So just knowing the anatomy of the foot and knowing which injuries are common, and being comfortable to localize the injury based on what the athlete or player or patient is describing in terms of the location and the character of the pain can be quite helpful to form your differential. The first thing is, if there's lots of bruising or if there's lots of swelling, even if the Ottawa foot rules are not met, I might add some sort of imaging, like an x-ray at least. If the right mechanism exists, then that ligament or that joint can be injured. So don't just discount it because a rule or a sort of guideline said that it shouldn't be injured. But once you finish your exam, if you think it's not injured, then you can ignore it comfortably. And then just palpate with precision. So you know exactly what you're palpating, know when you cross one joint over to another, and know how to test that joint, even if it's just the immobilization of the joint. So those are things that are going through your mind when you're seeing an acute injury. And again, if the patient is ambulatory and has minimal pain, you might get away with getting them back to playing. And you might also, in clinic, if it's, you know, week after the injury, you might get away with a lower grade diagnosis if they haven't had a huge amount of pain or a huge amount of swelling. But if there's severe pain, severe swelling, severe bruising, then your suspicion is higher. You think about getting some imaging. You can use ultrasound with good reliability if it's done with a skilled MSK tech, and if it's paired with your precision of anatomy and palpation if you can ask a good question. And then you can always think about an MRI if you're not sure or if things are not getting better.
And I think it's important for learners to remember to get imaging of both sides for something like this. When it can be so subtle, it's good to know what's normal for that patient. So if you are going to get an x-ray of the foot and to get it in weight bearing, do it on both sides and compare, and then you can have your control kind of built in, which can be helpful.
So for this case, we wanted to focus more around midfoot injuries. And so what are some of the more common mechanisms we see midfoot injuries in?
Well, why don't we talk about the Lisfranc injury first, because it's the kind of the big one that we all don't want to miss. And in order to talk about that, you need to understand what the Lisfranc complex and what the Lisfranc joint, what the Lisfranc ligament actually mean. The Lisfranc complex is the connection or the articulation between the tarso-metatarsal region of the foot. And specifically, it refers to where the first and second metatarsal meet up with the medial and the intermediate cuneiform bones. So that's the Lisfranc complex. And it's generally, that complex is generally stable with very little motion, because not only because of the osseous structure where the metatarsal, the second metatarsal fits in to the little groove that the cuneiform makes for it, almost makes a keystone, but also because of the ligament structures. And specifically, we're talking about the Lisfranc ligament, which connects the medial cuneiform to the second metatarsal. So it's kind of like a sling type ligament. And so the way to injure that complex, that structure, is by having that exact mechanism, having a plantar flexed foot with some sort of axial load coming through the heel, whether that's because you got stepped on or whether that's because you landed from a large height, that midfoot ligament or complex gets disrupted. And then there are different stages of injury. You can have a stage one injury where the ligament is sprained, but there's no separation of the metatarsals. And generally you can rehab that one with conservative measures and potentially some immobilization. But then there are stage two and three injuries where the ligament is ruptured and there's some diastasis of the metatarsal, plus or minus some loss of the arch height of the foot. And the more structural acquired deformity there is, the more severe injury is, essentially. And some of those more severe injuries, especially in athletes, require fixation, surgical intervention, more than just a boot and some rehab. Now, the other injuries that can happen often happen in similar mechanisms, where the foot is plantar flexed or the midfoot is loaded, maybe during the push off part of the stance, or sorry, of the gait. And other things you might want to look for are similar or analogous injuries, like metatarsal fractures that are a little bit more proximal, or maybe a little bit more lateral. And then the joint injuries between the tarsals and the metatarsals, between the tarsals themselves, all of those joints are separate places, and all of those joints have their own capsule, which can be injured. And all of those bones are connected by varying ligaments, which can also be sprained. So in the right context, with the right clinical picture and examination, any one of those are potentially targets for like a diagnosis of injury.
What are we telling these patients about their prognosis or things about what it looks like returning to sport?
So it really depends on what the injury is. If you're talking about a Lisfranc injury, then if it's just a low-grade injury with no separation of the bones and you think it's just ligamentous, then often you're just starting with some immobilization, especially if it's a high-velocity mechanism. You might put them in an air cast boot for 6 weeks or 8 weeks even, and then get them to the rehabilitation phase. And in the meantime, they can also be doing some non-weight bearing rehab or something lower weight, like in the pool. But I would want that to be kind of supervised by a physiotherapist or by a professional. Now, and I guess the next part of your question is, if it's a different type of injury, then I guess it just depends. If it's a fracture that's isolated and not part of the Lisfranc complex, maybe it's just a 4 to 6 week injury. If it's a joint sprain without any sort of fracture, maybe a capsular injury, something like that, something more minor, it might be 2 weeks or 4 weeks. And it also depends on how they load the foot and where exactly the injury is, and also their anatomical consideration. Some people will load different parts of their joint. Some people walk with an out toe or an in toe, and that will all determine where the load goes and how much an injury will actually be bothersome.
How long are patients non-weight bearing on the most minor end versus the more severe end of injury?
So for the most minor one, I would say like probably somewhere in the four to eight week range. I think 6 weeks is a reasonable general guideline, but of course you'll have to maybe be a bit flexible depending on the patient themselves. On the other side, if it's more severe, especially if it's an athlete, but even if it's not, a lot of these patients are going to end up with some sort of surgical management And there is some debate of between the lower end of the severe ones, whether it deserves or warrants, I should say, surgical fixation, which is usually like an ORIF. But that is usually going to be more on the 3 month side to be getting back to proper mobility. But when you have some sort of fixation like that, you're actually walking a lot more quickly because you essentially have that cast or the immobilization being done from the inside, which is a lot more stable than the external versions of it.
Okay, what types of chronic problems are we seeing with midfoot injuries?
The biggest problem with a Lisfranc injury, and the reason it's important to catch, is that it really does destabilize the architecture of the arch and of the midfoot. And so the arch collapses over time and becomes a fixed deformity, and the forefoot abducts a little bit. And that usually leads to, if nothing else, some biomechanical difficulties and some pain, but sometimes some advanced midfoot arthritis, osteoarthritis. And in those kind of cases, some surgical options like an arthrodesis or a fusion exist. And those are the reasons that you want to catch a Lisfranc injury earlier. Some of the other less aggressive injuries can tend to lead to more on the chronic pain side, like let's say a fracture that hasn't healed properly or took a long time to heal, or a ligament that just won't heal because of the biomechanics of the foot, not letting it rest properly, etc. Some of those things can, you know, lead to isolated arthritis in a joint or osteoarthritis in a joint or kind of a chronic ligamentous injury. And those ones we often try to manage with rehabilitation and maybe a podiatrist's opinion for a custom orthotic or a special kind of device or footwear. And sometimes we use injectable options like corticosteroid injections if it's, let's say, just an isolated capsule or injury or a joint injury, arthritis, something like that.
Can you use an orthotic to minimize the risk of progression to traumatic arthritis to maintain the architecture after the initial fracture? Or it happens so far after that you can't do that reliably?
I think the logic of that is sound. The collapse happens because there's no, that sling that the Lisfranc ligament is making is no longer in place, or at least no longer working the way it should. And so it allows the structure to sag. And eventually, as it sags more and more and the weight goes through it, it eventually just collapses completely and becomes a static kind of deformity. So I think the logic of using an orthotic or even some sort of dynamic taping method or a spring control strap or something like that can potentially prevent it. And there's certainly no harm in using them. But I think the evidence probably doesn't support it as an isolated treatment plan. And it certainly wouldn't be enough, especially in a more severe case, to just use an orthotic or a tape or something like that instead of a fixation.
Awesome. I think that was a great way to wrap up the second case there. And so we can move on to case three. Now this is involving a soccer player. So we can imagine a defender who's reaching for a tackle, but misses the tackle and the offensive player runs by. And while doing so, the defender steps on the back of their heel. And so with this mechanism, kind of similar to the last one, but what are you thinking about here in terms of mechanism or your initial thoughts?
Yeah, the mechanism is the most important. So depending on where the plantar flexion was happening, presumably in this case, we're talking about the toe. So if you're in a hyperextended state in the toe and then there's some loading of it, whether or not it's from being stepped on or, you know, kicking something or turfing and the ball or something like that, you're having a hyperextension type injury to the first MTP. And so you're thinking about a ligamentous or capsular injury to the first metatarsophalangeal joint.
And with this injury, are there any initial on-field assessments that you're performing and any reasons to be taking players out of the game?
The most obvious, but not that common finding that you'll have on exam initially is that if there's a complete tear of the ligamentous structure, there will be some laxity of the phalanx relative to the metatarsal. So we call that a vertical Lachman test, where you can kind of lift the phalanx up and there's more laxity. There, it rises dorsally more than the contralateral side. And that amount of laxity should tell you that there's been a rupture of that complex. And the complex that we're talking about specifically is called the plantar plate. And that's essentially a complex made of the joint capsule, the ligament, and the flexor hallucis brevis, which is where the two sesamoids are embedded within. So that whole structure is on the plantar side of the MTP and can have a sprain or a kind of a partial tear or even a rupture. And if there's a full rupture, you would be able to see some laxity. If there's no laxity, you might still be able to increase your suspicion of that injury by getting someone to hyperextend the toe, even just passively could hurt, or during the push-off phase of their gait. Now, again, the same rule applies that if you are more mobile and have less pain, then you probably have a lower grade injury and the risk of further injury is probably a little bit lower. So if somebody is able to walk normally and go through the toe off portion of their gait in a reasonable way, usually you need, 40 to 60 degrees of dorsiflexion of the toe to have a smooth gait. You also need lots of dorsiflexion of the hyperextension of the toe to be able to run or especially sprint. So if you're able to do those activities and have minimal pain and not be antalgic and still be able to, dodge something that's coming your way or be able to protect yourself, then I would say it's fair to return to play. And if you can't do those things even on the side of the field, then it's kind of a no-brainer. And if you have the benefit of having a therapist or a trainer, and it's important enough to get back into the game that day right there, then there are probably some taping methods that you can use to stabilize the joint. And if it's not right away, then there are also some devices or different kinds of shoes you can wear that involve more of a rigid forefoot, like a work shank boot, or there's even something called a turf toe plate, something that keeps the front of the foot more rigid to stop the pain. Obviously that affects your mobility, and in certain cases it's not practical depending on what sport you're playing.
So would you be able to walk us through your general discussion with patients and your thoughts on prognosis for these types of injuries?
So it all depends on what happens. So if you have a minor injury, for example, a grade 1 sprain of the plantar plate, there's no tearing, there's no dissociation, there's no muscular injury, you're probably looking at, 2 or 3 weeks, maybe 4 weeks to get back to normal activity. And sometimes, depending on the kind of severity within that grade 1, you might need some sort of rehabilitation, someone to help mobilize the joint a little bit better, maybe some anti-inflammatory medications, and maybe some offloading of the joint, whether it's just to not play or whether it's to have a crutch or a boot for a week or so. However, if you're talking about the more severe injuries, like a rupture of the plantar plate, grade 3 injury, complete rupture, you might be looking at, 4 or 6 weeks even of immobilization of the foot. You want to allow that capsule and the ligamentous complex to heal. So you really want to avoid any sort of dorsiflexion. And sometimes we're even taping the toe in kind of a plantar flexed position, not a dramatic plantar flexion, but just a kind of subtle. And sometimes those patients actually need some sort of operative intervention to repair the ligamentous complex. Sometimes the sesamoid will retract if part of the muscle has torn, and that needs to be reapproximated as well. And sometimes the sesamoids can even fracture with that kind of injury. So the prognosis for those is quite a bit worse. Where usually if they're having an acute repair within a week or a few weeks of the injury, usually a return to sport is expected to be about 4 months, 3-4 months. But with more severe injuries, there are also more potential complications. Sometimes we can see a hallux rigidus, which is essentially a late sequela of the plantar plate rupture. Essentially what happens is the capsule stops being as mobile. Maybe that's because of scar tissue. Sometimes we treat it with a keelectomy, like, just debride it, a debridement. they try to give some motion back. Sometimes that toe ends up getting fused depending on the severity of the pain and dysfunction. And I guess I should add, if you have a rigid hallux, that's kind of a very disruptive injury to an athlete. Your efficiency of running and sprinting and cutting are very, very highly affected if you have that kind of injury.
And so I wanted to talk a little bit about treatment as well. And I was wondering what you say to patients about rehab or physiotherapy, maybe medications, and even possibly injections if you use any of those modalities.
The most important thing is treating it early. So resting that joint, or at least relative resting, depending on the severity of the injury. We want to obviously allow for the swelling. So we don't want to tape it right away, but there's some taping you can do. For example, that plantar flexion that I just mentioned, or even just to stabilize the joint complex. And then sometimes we use a stiff shoe or even a rocker bottom shoe to help limit the amount of extension that you need to go through to get through your stance phase and push off phase of your gait. And then physiotherapy, I think almost everybody with this kind of injury should see some sort of rehab specialist. And the goal of it would be to help restore some motion. So that would be just by mobilizing the joint with some manual treatment. And also if there's some muscular portion of the injury, to help rehabilitate that tendon, and sometimes to help with some activity modifications or some advice about how to offload the joint, whether it's with devices like that we already talked about, or whether it's with gait changes or sport changes. But the rehab specialist, like a physiotherapist, can be very helpful to take some time and provide advice and reassurance for the patient, along with just the therapy.
Yeah, I think relying on our allied health practitioners and providers to really help get the patients back week to week is so key. They really help create that individualized rehab plan and allow that tailored approach that can be so helpful. There really isn't that one size fits all, even with similar injuries. So working with providers in your neighborhood who you know, who you trust, and who you can have good dialogue with as a physician can be very helpful for these patients' general return, as well as the athletic trainers involved with team sports.
I would say that I often have a discussion with patients about the real value of a good rehab specialist is to be able to troubleshoot. Because anyone can go on YouTube and find a bunch of exercises. But a lot of the time, especially the patients who actually end up in our clinics, are not getting better. And they've tried a bunch of physio sessions, or they've jumped from person to person and not getting better. And I always try to explain to them that the real value is that you should be able to be comfortable going back to that person and saying, you know, this exercise hurt me more, or this didn't work. How can I fix it? And someone who knows what they're doing will be able to make modifications and give you different advice and help you figure out why that motion specifically was hurting. So like you said, the value of having someone you trust and some open dialogue with them, both for the patient and for the practitioner, is very, very important.
I've learned so much from this episode. I think you've made very complex injuries very user-friendly, easy to understand. Are there any final clinical pearls for our listeners in terms of those that might be afraid to see a foot and ankle patient? It seems overwhelming for them, how to get comfortable.
I think that the anatomy is by far the most important, especially for the foot. And then maybe followed by a close second by the foot, the biomechanics of the foot, how it actually works and moves. If you're comfortable with the anatomy and you can, even if you just start with being able to identify where you're palpating and what you're actually touching or where the patient is pointing, I think that gives you a lot of confidence to be able to work through what structure is injured, especially once you hear the story of the mechanism and you have an idea of where the twist or where the load happened. So don't be afraid to even pull up a picture of the anatomy and get the patient to point at it and say, you know, yeah, this is where it hurts. Because while they're doing that, you're also reviewing the anatomy and figuring out like which joint could be injured and how you might test that joint based on your knowledge of how it moves. And the other thing is that can make you quite a bit more confident is to just kind of go a little bit beyond your comfort level in terms of your reading. So for example, when we're talking about the midfoot, and you learn about all the bones, and then you go ahead and learn about a Lisfranc injury, which is a more rare injury and maybe you need a bit more specialization to understand. Now that you have this knowledge, you might automatically feel comfortable about kind of the more run of the mill injuries, or, you know, an osteoarthritis or a joint sprain. So I'd always encourage you to kind of read one more thing and expand your knowledge and your differential that way, just to improve your confidence.
Very helpful advice. Anatomy coloring books can be great. Mm-hmm. And then using your own foot and ankle, palpating on yourself while you're looking at radiopedia or just general image can be so helpful in order to figure out, as you move the foot and ankle, while you're trying to learn the mechanics to understand the mechanism of injury, how your own foot and ankle is moving. So I encourage everyone to use themselves as a model for learning. Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Morali. This has been an incredible episode. I think there's a lot of clinical pearls for learners to take away, and hopefully they all feel more comfortable and confident with the foot and ankle moving forward.
Thanks so much for having me.
The information provided in this podcast and on this website is intended for a Canadian audience. It is for informational purposes only and does not create a physician-patient relationship. It is not to be used as professional medical advice, diagnosis, treatment, or care, nor is it intended to be used as a substitute. Anyone with any questions regarding medical conditions, issues, or problems should seek the advice of a physician. These cases used in this podcast were invented and do not use real people. If there's any resemblance, it's completely coincidental.